Hi, it's Wednesday night, just before Happy New Year. They still do this stuff to when I was a kid, with they popped a balloon or ball in Times Square or something like that. I don't think anybody go to Times Square today in Mamdani's, New York, but be that as it may. But life goes on, and I want to take a look at the Parsha, Parsha's Vayechi this week, and it's being sponsored by good friends, the Luxembourg, Shmuel Nechama Luxembourg. And he's the chairman of the board of TA, so responds to me because, and I'm reading here, why not? Why not? That's the motto, the caring and dedicated staff of Lamdeinu at TA. That's a program that provides special educational extras for kids that need it, which is a very good thing, who provide additional learning support so many of our eager and spirited Talmidim. Can any boy learn Mishnayos? Read a Daf Gemara? Solve a challenging math problem? Why not? There is no challenge too large to tackle, and we are sponsoring in honor of the incredible staff and Talmidim of Lamdeinu who meet these challenges head-on each and every day. The Lamdeinu Cause Match will take place on January 7 and 8, so please keep an eye out for its launch. This is the Learning Support Center in TA. Like I said, they should have had that when I was a kid. But anyhow, so thank you very much, and it is a good cause, obviously. Very good cause, and we always appreciate their support. Parsha Vayechi is in my mind, you know, first of all, leaves a lot of, it's always very interesting, leaves a lot of loose ends, and also conforms to the theory I've had for a long time that Bereishis, especially the whole Torah, deals with, if you think about it, deals with imperfections. Things are supposed to go a certain way, and they don't go that way. They go a different way. For example, Vayechi Yaakov Eretz Kanan Shvas Reishana. Yaakov has his quiet retirement in Egypt, the last 17 years of his life. But in Egypt, not in Israel. Wait a minute. I thought, Vayeshev Yaakov Eretz Kanan Beretz Megori Aviv. Remember it said, Bikesh Yaakov Leisha B'Shava. When Yaakov returned from Laban, he was not a young man. And he basically said, all right, my troubled days are over. I went through the old love and junk, and I survived the Esav encounter. And now I want to sit down, you know, XX and the Peckle Boehner, as they used to say when I was a kid, right? And it covers the Lavrugas of Yosef, but we know it didn't happen because the Joseph story happened. So Yaakov's plans for retirement didn't work out. He wanted, as we would say today, you know, he had a whole plans to retire in Israel, and instead he retired in Florida. All right, you know, could be worse. People do that, I'm told. It's not Israel. It's not where Yaakov wanted to spend the last year of his life. And we know this, among other things, he's really obsessed, properly so, being buried in Israel. Okay? So you see, it's supposed to be, ideally, that Yaakov retires, as it were, spends the last years of his life, after going through all the junk, in Eretz Yisrael, but doesn't happen the way. Instead, it's in Egypt, and it's in a funny situation. It's in the land of Goshen, where they are all being supported by monthly social security checks, welfare checks from Yosef, who is supporting them by Yechalko Yosef Ezechov, the Avi Vesechov. But it's a funny kind of existence. Yaakov and Avram Yitzchak, if you think about it, were pretty doggone independent. They were nomads, they were shepherds, and that's what they wanted to be. And like Yonas and Asia says, if you're a shepherd, you work for yourself, and you know, when things aren't good, you pick up and move somewhere else. When there was a famine, they moved this place. When there was a war, they moved that place. You know, that's what a shepherd is. And they really are pretty darn independent, if you ever think about it. Avram, you didn't mess with him. Same thing with Yitzhak. Remember the fights with the wells that they had, the different wells that people dug, and the wars and stuff that they engaged in. That's how it was. And now, Yaakov and the Bnei Yisrael find themselves in a radically non-independent matzav, don't they? They really are dependent on getting a government check all the time, which comes regularly, because Yosef was the viceroy of Egypt, and he kept his word. And he was a good guy, and so on and so forth. So they lacked for nothing, and they had everything they need. as we would say today, just sit and learn and all the rest of it. They tended sheep. It's just an interesting life. Here you are, the Shvatim, Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, Yisachar, Zvulun, all those guys. And they are spending the last years of their lives also not in Israel. They are going to die in Egypt. And they know it. And it's a little bit funny, because that wasn't the plan that they had in the beginning. And they will have children and all that, but it'll be a Golus experience. Now is the real time of the Golus experience. You find Pasha Baichi. They settle down, and they realize they're going to live there, live out their lives. It's not like Mashiach is coming tomorrow. So, you know, it's funny. And the truth of the matter is, this idea of living and dying in Egypt becomes addictive later on as the generations go by. And even though Yosef says, remember when you leave, take my bones out, all the rest of it. But as we all know, they don't want to leave eventually. All four-fifths want to stay behind and perish. And even when they leave, they don't take his bones out. Moshe Rabbeinu was a tzaddik. So, you know, he kept the word out of several million people. I don't know if you ever thought about this. When the Bnei Yisrael leave Mitzrayim, they're all looking for gold and silver. And Moshe Rabbeinu alone goes for the Atzmas Yosef. It's the famous Chazal, right? I forget the pasuk that they use, but, you know, this one is looking for Kesef Azov, and this one is looking for Mitzvahs. Chacham Levi Yikach Mitzvahs. I think that's the pasuk. And did you ever ask yourself the following question? How come it was Moshe Rabbeinu who had to go for the Atzmas Yosef? What about Ephraim and Menashe? It was their ancestor, right? But they didn't do it. It was up to a guy named Moshe, because Ephraim and Menashe were busy grabbing the gold. Now, Hashem told them to, you know, that's, you know, they shall borrow from Egypt. I get that. But somewhere along the line, in the middle of the day, while you're copying this guy's gold and that guy's gold and this guy's, this lady's dresses and that lady's dresses, whatever they're doing, somebody says, what about Zadie? You know, Yosef, here's what's happening. They didn't do it. That shows you how much Egypt got into their heads that, you know, they're already worshiping the golden calf when they're in Egypt because they're chasing after the gold. And what happens later on with the golden calf is nothing but a certain manifestation of this. It's kind of funny. So, Bikesh Yaakov Leisha B'Shalva. Well, Yaakov gets a shalva, but of a funny kind. And it's in Mitzrayim. And, you know, it's what it is. Now, he's afraid that he will die in Egypt and be buried there. Right? I don't know if you noticed this. It's a little bit weird, but after he dies, Yosef tries to get permission for his father to be buried in Israel, to leave the country. And I don't know why, but for some reason it wasn't easy to do that. And it's very interesting to me that Yosef does not approach Pharaoh and ask him, can I take my father out? But instead, if you look at the psukim, you'll see that Yosef approaches third parties. Okay? He talks at Avdi Paro. And he says, will you lobby on my behalf for Pharaoh? See, I'm Jewish. He might not like what I'm saying. But if you say it, and you present it the right way, maybe he'll say yes. It's funny, isn't it? I mean, let's put it this way. Yosef knew Paro. I'm sure they communicated all the time because Yosef is in charge of the economy and had to give updates and reports. And Yosef had a very powerful position. But when it comes to asking for a personal favor, he's reticent. Isn't that funny? He's reticent. I can only surmise that when Yosef presented his father and the brothers to Paro in last week's Parsha, wasn't the greatest occasion. And Paro wasn't, you know, so turned on by them. And, you know, whatever. Instead, Yosef says, if I found favor in your eyes, please speak to Paro. Now, let me tell you something. When Yosef says, if I found favor in your eyes, he's giving him money. You know, let's put it this way. You go over to an Egyptian lobbyist. He's like this. Here's a New Year's present of $50,000. If I found favor in your eyes, would you say a good word to Pharaoh and let me go and bury my father outside of Israel? You see that the court Jew, even when he's got a lot of power, doesn't have a lot of power. You know what I'm saying? Even when he's the viceroy of Egypt, he has to constantly walk on eggs and never overstep the boundaries. That is how Yosef was successful, right? He obviously made a close study, as court Jews have always done, of the local society and their mores and their customs. He had to do it. If he wants to live, he wants to succeed. Don't you think there are people who insulted him? Don't you think that there were factions at the court who were jealous and didn't like him? But he's got to, you know, he's got to learn not to, punch back, except when occasion offers. And when it comes to power, you got to be very careful. Never to say the wrong thing, because with a king like that, you say one wrong line and you're fired and you're out and all the rest of it. That's how it goes. So Yosef, therefore, very smartly, says, who's the type of person that power would listen to? And that's the guy I will give a New Year's present, you know, of lifelong tickets to Disneyland or something like that. And now if I found favor in your eyes, you know, please speak to power on my behalf. You know, that son-in-law of yours that you wanted to be appointed grain inspector of Lower Egypt? Well, the job just opened up, right? The vacancy just opened up. And I think your son will be a great guy, or your son-in-law, or whoever it is that you want for it. This is how life goes. Now, when they speak to Paro, he says, tell him something very interestingly. Bekivri asher korisi li be'eretz Kanaan. Yaakov says, I already dug a hole. Did you see that? He said, I want to be buried in Maris Machpelah. And I already dug the ground. Meaning, in previous times, when Leah died, now, as you know, Rachel is not buried there, and Yaakov has to sort of like apologize for not burying Rachel in the Maris Machpelah. He tries to explain to Yosef and all that. But he said, when I buried Leah, in a hole in the ground, obviously in the cave, I also dug a hole right next to it. Bekivri asher korisi le'eretz Kanaan. Shama tzik b'reini. That's a little bit weird. But it's like saying, you know, this is where I'm going to lie. And I guess that must be something in Egypt where if somebody digs a hole in the ground, you know, you see, that's where he's destined to be or something like that. Because otherwise, why would the Torah bother to tell us this? We believe that everything in the Torah has some reason. So it can't just be for rhetoric. So why does it have to say that Yaakov? We wouldn't know this elsewhere when it says he buried Leah. I don't believe it. As far as I can remember, it doesn't say that Yaakov also dug a hole next to him, next to Leah. So the whole thing was already done. It's just interesting. Okay? So Yaakov doesn't want to be buried in Egypt. That's, of course, why they embalm him. Because otherwise, you tell me, you take a body and transport it for days and days across the desert and so forth to get to Eretz Yisrael. It's going to decompose, be full of worms, it'll be putrid, it'll be disgusting. And in Egypt, apparently, they had this business of Shivim Yom, you know, that they had this national mourning, ceremony, which Yaakov is subject to. And what are you going to say? I don't want your stupid Egyptian burial customs. That would be an insult to Egypt. So even though Yaakov does not want to be mourned by the Egyptians, and he was always afraid, Chazal tell us, with perfectly understandable reason, he doesn't want to be turned into a god, which is very easy to happen in Egypt, especially if it's true, what Chazal say, then when Yaakov showed up, the famine stopped. So naturally, 1 + 1 = 2. You're Egyptian. You say, we had a famine. And then all of a sudden, this guy showed up and started raining. So he must be a god of some form. And he didn't want that. So Yosef said, well, you have to vayachanot. You know, you have to embalm him. However, you work out the halachic side of that. But you have to embalm him, because that way you'll be able to take him there. This is a problem I always have with the story that you go to Tveria. I'm a Kohen, but you go to Tveria and the Rambam's buried there, right? Now, you know the story. How's the Rambam buried in Tveria? I don't know the answer to that, because he died in the early 1200s. I mean, did they really take his body which smelled up and stink up and you know, all the things that happened to a body, and schlep it across Egypt, across the Sinai Desert, all the way up to Tveria. I mean, maybe they did, but it's very unusual. It's very against the Jewish ethic. And they didn't embalm him, not in the 13th century. So, 13th century CE, not BCE. And so what's with that? Now, maybe there's some aspect of burial I don't know about, which is certainly the case. maybe to put him in a lead box or something like that until they buried him. But in Yaakov's case, obviously, they did Chanota. They'll do it also Yosef later on, as we know. So Yaakov would rather have lived his last years in Israel, but didn't work out. And he doesn't want it to be said also of his burial. He wanted to be buried in Israel, but instead he got buried in Egypt. There are some who say that all the Shvatim are buried in Eretz Yisrael, and others say not. In other words, there are those who say that even though the Torah doesn't tell you, but, Yisachar, Zvulun, Dan, Naphtali, all those people are also buried in Eretz Yisrael. Only Yosef was buried in Egypt and had to be schlepped was schlepped to Israel. The others not. Others say, like you've heard this, Rashi talks about it, Reuven, the bones were shattered in the box and all the rest of it. But the Pashim Shat in Vayechi is one was buried in Israel and the others were not. That means, it's weird. It means Yehuda, Sheva Yehuda, the guy, Yehuda ben Yaakov, Levi ben Yaakov, the founder of the Levium, Yisachar, Zvon, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, Asher, all buried in Egypt somewhere. That's mamish weird, right? These great people, they transport the bodies today in Newark for America to be buried in Israel, and the Shiftei Kar not buried in Israel. Again, it's a weird story. Goes to show you that it's got to be some reason for that. And I've said before that, in Kabbalah especially, Mitzrayim is not Pashut. The Arizal, went there late to live there and so forth. It's not simply another country. But how it works out is just strange, because you think of all people. That's the reason why there is an opinion in Chazal that really they were all buried in Israel. It makes life more easy if you advance that argument. But we don't know. And there are different opinions of Chazal. Some say they were, some say they weren't. I'm always interested in the ones that don't fit the pattern so easily. Because they are in Chazal, but they're not so verfrumt. So how do they work that out? Right? Similarly, another big business is the blessing of Yaakov and the sons. It says, He also let me tell you what's going to happen in Achor Sayyamim. That means what's going to happen at the end of time, and time Mashiach and so forth. But he doesn't do it. So based on that, Chazal say, Rashi quotes it, that Yaakov wanted to tell him when Mashiach was coming, but then he was prevented, right? And that was Minashamayim, he was prevented. Which is why he switches to an entirely different non sequitur. Instead of talking about Achris HaYamim, he starts talking about the faults and virtues of each of the kids. Which is a strange story also, right? The Yaakov wanted to tell the kids, which means that the Jews, even though they were living in the life of Riley, you would think, as I said before, they didn't even have to work hard. And they got their government check all the time. And their brother was the ruler, viceroy, or something like that of Egypt. Secretary of the economy, whatever you call it. They weren't so happy, right? Because Yaakov, basically the question was, when are we getting out of here? It's a little bit like, what's that famous novel from James Hilton, Shangri-La, Lost Horizon? Remember, they fly, they messed up on the plane, they end up in Shangri-La, but they want to get out of there. They want to get back home, even though they have everything in the Shangri-La. So the Jews in Egypt, so to speak, had everything. Yeah, but it wasn't home. And they want to get out of there. And how long is this going to be? And Yaakov, to their horror, I'm sure, is dying in Egypt because he's gathering them around before he dies. That's the whole point. And I guess there must have been a shock that our father's not going back to Eretz Yisrael in the end. And then maybe it dawns on them, and then I guess we aren't either. And are our children, or our children's children, they didn't know the future exactly. And here's another one. I think Lee Lowenstein brought it to my attention. Did they know about the Bris Men of Sarum and the prophecy that there'll be 400 years in a strange land? Va'avadum ve'inu mosam? I don't know the answer to that. Did they know this is going to be this way? Did they suspect that where they are in Egypt is the fulfillment of this? Did they know what you and I know? I'm sure they didn't. But you and I know that Hashem, Chishiv is a case at the end. He's jiggling the books. And, you know, he's going to use part of the years that they had in Egypt prosperity and count that against Vavon Avinu or some. That's what we believe. You know, they're supposed to be there so and so many years, and you can count it, especially if you say you count the 400 years from the birth of Yitzhak, when the Jews were not even in Eretz Mitzrayim. But some of them didn't know that. So suppose I told you, Mamish, like today, you're living in the USA, it's a good country, but soon is coming a different time, and your children or your grandchildren will be slaves. How much like the Negro slaves were hundreds of years ago? And your children will be slaves and tortured and suffering in the USA for 400 years. Assuming that Arba Me'ashana means Arba Me'ashana. Because you know how it works. God's year could be 1,000 years. That must have really like super freaked everybody out if they knew that prophecy. Now Yaakov knew the prophecy, I'm sure. Did the Shvatim, I don't know the answer to that question. It's a good question. But those kind of issues were hovering over the heads of the Jews, the Jewish leaders, certainly in Egypt, even though the Parsha doesn't talk about it so much. But Yaakov was not given permission, Min HaShemayim, to tell him about how long it would last. I suspect that maybe Yaakov was trying to tell them, when it says, Ba'achris HaYomim, maybe it doesn't mean Achris HaYom as we usually define it to talk about Mashiach time, but maybe Yaakov was going to tell him how long they're going to be in Egypt. Achris HaYom, what will be the end of the days that they're in Egypt? Notice, I want you guys to know that in about 20 years, 50 years, whatever it is from now, there's going to be a period of 86 years of servitude, and it'll be Avodas Parech, and it'll be all kind of terrible things, and it'll be Kol HaBein HaYelod HaYorot HaShlichul, they'll kill the babies, but Achris HaYom Yetzir Berchush Gadol. Right? And this is the timeline. But he wasn't able to tell him that. Now, I don't know. I've never seen anybody say that. I'm sure somebody must say it. If I thought somebody must say it. But I have a suspicion that that's what it means, Bachor Sayyamim. But he's not given a chance to do that. And so he has to shift to something else. And the best I can make out of it is, if he's not allowed to tell his children and progeny, but Bachor Sayyamim, it must mean that they're not worthy of it, right? Otherwise, why not tell? If they're not worthy of it, then I better, before I go, Yaakov says, I better call their attention to their faults or their virtues, right? And Reuven is impulsive, and Shimon and Levi are violent, and the other one's a businessman, and, you know, all the rest of it, right? All that we know, right? The ones we know. And so that would explain why instead of talking about Achris HaYomim, he talks about their personal character traits, which is very interesting because Yaakov is 147 years old and he's known them all their lives. And now he's touching them up for themselves, at least from his point of view. Now, I'm sure Shimon and Levi didn't regard themselves as violent. As far as we know, they did one massacre one time when their sister was raped. It's not like they were gunslingers or something like that. Think about this. We always think Shimon and Levi killed out a whole city. I mean, I get it. I know that. And Yaakov confirms it. And he said, I don't want to have nothing to do with you. To be perfectly honest, what does the Torah tell us about Shimon and Levi? Right? What does it tell us? Only the story of Dina. Doesn't tell you anything else. As far as I know, Shimon Levi could have been mild-mannered guys who were really ticked off by what happened to their sister, which was an outrage. And they went after it with a cheshbon because HaKizona Yasa Zachar Seinu. And, you know, Yaakov didn't approve of it, but it's not like they, like I say, went around all the time starting a JDL or something like that. I don't know if you thought about it, but he sure comes down hard on them. So Yaakov is saying like this, you only did it once, but I see you have it in you. So therefore, Klei Chamas Mecherasam, Ki Ba'apram Hargu Ish, or Samik Ushor, whatever the Lashon is. You understand? The parent is telling the child, I saw this manifested one time, but it shows what you have in your character. That's a rough, what's the right word? It's a high standard to high bar. You see? Somebody all of his life is nice and polite, but one time they lose their temper and they scream and they cuss out someone else. And the parent says, I see you have this rishis in you. I'm living for 50 years. I did it once. What do you want for my life? Nope. That shows you, it's like al derech ha-musar, you know what I mean? If you did it once, you show you have this mita in you. And therefore, achal can be out of feast in Yisrael. It's just strange. Now, the hardest one as I can understand is the Joseph story because the language is so obscure. Bein paros Yosef, bein paros Ali, how's it go? Bein paros Yosef, bein paros Ali Oyen, banat stal Ashur. What does the words even mean, bein paros Yosef? We don't know. I know the different opinions, right? And I'm sure you do also. Yosef is fruitful, or he's like he's beautiful like a young donkey. It's the Middle East, you know, so that's how they talk over there. Or other things like that. The best one, I mean, let me put it this way, the most poignant is Abarbanel, as is often the case. Check out, look up the Abarbanel. Bein Parso Yosef, you are the son of my beautiful wife, Rachel. He still hasn't gotten over her. You understand? Knows you inherited her looks. It says, Yosef, you fate tar, you fate mara. When I look at you, I think of Rachel. Isn't that something? Yaakov was 147 years old. The wives were gone for a while. But still, he looks at Yosef. He says, I see your mother. Right? Now, how does he praise Yosef? It's the antithesis of Shimon and Levi. Right? It's the antithesis of Shimon and Levi. Shimon and Levi fly off the handle. Yosef holds his temper. People shot at him arrows. Who shoots at Yosef arrows? When did that happen? We're not told. Right? As far as I can see, we're not told. So what are they talking about, the shooting arrows at him? Means, as I can understand it, you know, the brothers. Right? And so forth. The brothers were shooting him. In other words, first of all, it may be, I wasn't there, that they did try to kill him on a certain occasion by shooting at him and missed. It could be, right? But if you don't say that, I mean, because they held him a rotif. If you don't say that, then, I mean, you know, they could have timed it. We were shooting the animal, we missed. You know, let me tell you something, being around the gun, it's a dangerous business. Anybody knows about guns will tell you if you don't point it in the wrong direction. So he was shot at by arrows. Or the arrows of Lashon Hara. Right? Because I'm sure there was a drumbeat of bad words against him. And maybe even when they're in Egypt, maybe they're talking against him. And what does it say? And what does Yaakov praise over there? Right? Batesha Basin Kasto. He didn't shoot back. His bow remained steady. His arms remained limber. You see? So they shot at him. He didn't shoot back. So Yaakov is basically saying like this. You're now the viceroy in Egypt. You're in control. We're all in your hands. If you want to, you could kill us all. You could certainly kill Shimon and Levi who tried to hurt you, according to Chazal. But you don't. So they shoot at you, but you don't shoot. You don't shoot at them. That's godless, right? That's why it's a male of Vichavi Azrecha, Beishani Vivarchecha, Birchot Shemaim, y'all. You know, that's where you get the big thing. What's this business with girls standing on the. What is that? Now, I know Rashi, and I mean, I know the Chazal that the girls used to stand and watch him. Is that what Yaakov is talking about? First of all, how does Yaakov even know that? You know, I mean, was he at a Joseph parade and Yaakov was checking out, saying the girls are jumping? I mean, I doubt that. As far as we know, Yaakov moved to Goshen, made one trip to visit Pharaoh, and that was it. Spent the rest of the time in Goshen, as far as we know. And it was Yaakov Avinu, he wasn't checking out, you know, bonus all day, like, sure. And I don't know, I'm not sure what it means. What I'm trying to say is like this. I know the Midrashic interpretations, but what does it mean when you have over here, you know, how would you do it al derech hapshat? Why is he making a point of this? Why don't you simply say like this? You're good looking, right? Unless it's like a veiled reference to the Eishes Potiphar story. Notice, Yaakov doesn't want to be vulgar. And so you see, bonus solid, sure. I know you were a heartthrob to the women, but you know something? You know, you were a good boy and you didn't mess around in that department. So bonus solid, sure, would be, you know, some kind of reference to that. You see how obscure all this stuff is? Because the Birchas Yaakov are kind of a certain oracle, it's written in poetic language. It's not Pashut, okay? It's not Pashut. But certainly, if he's criticizing Shimon Levi for being violent, and he's criticizing Reuven for being impulsive, he's praising Yosef for the opposite. You are not impulsive, and you're not violent, okay? That's what I like about you. The only problem I have with this every year, as I always mention whenever I do a podcast in this parasha, is most of these Shvatim disappear pretty early in Jewish history. I guess they're coming back. Maybe they are. Maybe they aren't. I told you some machlokas and Chazal. What are you praising Yosef exactly for? How does Yosef work out later in Jewish history? Ephraim and Menashe. Not so great. The leadership doesn't come from Ephraim and Menashe. The leadership comes from Yehuda and possibly Levi, you know, the political versus the spiritual. It's hard to make, you know, sense out of all that. But the notion that a parent wants to touch up the child is a very fascinating one. I'm asking you, the listeners out there, don't do this unless you want to, obviously. Suppose I say like this. Let's say, for example, you have four kids. I'm just making this up. Write a paragraph touching up each one of your four kids. It wouldn't be so simple. What's the essence of that child? I mean, to be honest, not just to shoot the bull. To be honest, like Yaakov is being honest over here, right? He's on his deathbed. We did divrei shchivra keksuvim dami. You know, when a person's on the deathbed, they're telling the truth. And so, you know, how is Yaakov touching it up? And when he says, Asher shmein alachma, Asher will have rich food and provide delicacies for a king. This is how you think of Asher? He's a foodie, you know? Naphtali ayel shlucha. Naphtali is like a doe set free. That's beautiful fawns. You know, what is that? Or God gedud yigudeno. God will be attacked by raiders, but he will attack them at their heels. Is this the touch up of a human being? Now, if it's Yaakov, the answer is yes. But it's funny how he encapsulates his own small. So I'm throwing these out at you to show you how many loose ends, as I said before, there are in the parsha. And how the story ends in a very complex way, because you and I know that what's going to come next week's parsha is that Bnei Israel, after the time of Yaakov and after the time of Yosef, that's true, are going to mess up. And so do we see any hints of the mess up in Vayechi? You see? Or do we say everything was perfect and later on came the mess up? It's a very good, it's one of those questions which the question is more important than the answer, because you can give different answers. The question raises all kind of issues. And it's going to be important for us today, those who are listening, because it's important Golus, right? These are descriptions of the Jewish people in Golus. This will be successful, this won't be successful, this will be violent, this won't be able to know when to hold, keep his mouth shut, this one will know, you know, be like a vine, that one won't. This one will be attacked by raiders, but this one will attack them back at their heels. It's, you know, these are all, you know, prescriptions, descriptions of the Jews in like a Gullus type situation. And which of these virtues do you have, or do your kids have? And which of these faults do you have, or do your kids have? I think that's the most fruitful way of approaching thoughtfully consideration of this famous passage of the blessings of Yaakov before he dies. Oh, I went very long. All right. Sorry about that. I want to thank once again Mishpachas Luxembourg, Shmuel Nechum Luxembourg. And again, he's the chairman of TA. And so it's very nice that he's doing this for Lamdeinu. And as he said, they're coming up this coming week with a fundraiser. You can't go wrong with that. You're really helping the kids that need it. And anyway, with that, I wish everybody a good week.